The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
If you're really actually trying to deal with this problem, you need to deal with it from a 360-degree perspective. So I would say there is a public safety issue, but there are cybersecurity issues. There are issues with respect to civil rights and civil liberties. There are issues with respect to human rights around the world. There are issues with maintaining the innovation culture that we have in this industry. There are issues with maintaining the competitiveness of, at least here, U.S. industries, right? And if you're not taking into consideration all of those factors and various sectors of the folks involved in this debate, I think sometimes underemphasize various parts of that 360-degree world, then you're just not going to come up with something that's going to work. You're not going to come up with a solution that's going to be viable. And the reason this is a hard problem is because it is so complicated in those various ways.
I'm Susan Hennessy, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 4th, 2018. In August, legal and technical experts gathered in Santa Barbara, California, for the Crypto 2018 workshop on encryption and surveillance to further the ongoing debate over the impact of strong encryption and law enforcement surveillance capabilities. Over the past several days, Lawfare has published a series of reflections that capture some of the views presented at that conference. On this episode of the Lawfare Podcast, we've brought you one of the conversations from the event itself, in which Jim Baker of Brookings and Lawfare, Cindy Cohen of the EFF, Sven Herpig of the New Responsibilities Foundation, Adam Ingle of Australia's Department of Home Affairs, and Ian Levy of the UK's GCHQ discussed recent developments in the laws and policies governing surveillance and encryption around the world. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 370, Global Developments in Encryption and Surveillance Law.
I want to just say a couple things about what we're aiming to do. First and foremost, we were asked to help provide this community both a policy overview of how this issue is developing around the world and also a way to take a look at some of the underlying technical questions about some of the ideas that are being proposed about how to address this challenge of encryption and surveillance. I think I was first at this conference in maybe 1996 or 97 when we had the first round of this debate. That, there we are. And Santa Barbara looks remarkably the same. And this issue, I have to say, doesn't look the same, which is sort of interesting. I think that people look at this question through different lenses and sort of argue about what the priority is and what the really important thing is. And I want to just point to what I think is the complexity of this question that has really grown, I think, since the 1990s. Some people think of this as a cybersecurity question. It's just about whether the proposed systems to be put in place create security risk or not in the infrastructure. That's a really important question. Some people look at this through the lens of civil liberties and human rights. What happens if we enable surveillance more than it currently is around the world? Some people look at this as a question of industrial organization and pretty critical issues about how we organize the relationship between what are now quite essential industries, the internet industries, software industry, just to name a few that would be affected here, that are, you know, major parts of the global economy. And some people look at this as a question of public safety and crime fighting. How have we ended up changing the investigative environment that police and national security officials work in? So I think those are all really important, and we're going to try to, and I think anyone who suggests that you privilege one over the other, I would personally suggest is probably missing the point. But the challenge of making progress here, both from a policy perspective and a technical perspective, is that if you're not thinking about all of those dimensions of this issue in defining a way forward or defining approach, you're, I think, really missing something. We're going to dive right into this panel discussion. To begin with, I'm going to ask Ian Levy, who's the technical director of the UK National Cybersecurity Centre.
So Ian Levy, technical director for the UK's National Cybersecurity Centre. Why is a National Cybersecurity Centre talking about exceptional access? Well, because governments have a habit of ignoring the technical stuff. So we're trying to make sure that the UK government tries to make statements based on technical accuracy. So I'm just going to talk really quickly about how I see things. So I think the first thing is the narrative's broken. So as of today, we're talking about angels and demons. You've got a bunch of people on one side going, you governments don't understand this math stuff. You can't uninvent the number five. And on the other side, you've got a bunch of governments going, you bunch of maths geeks don't understand there are bad people in the world. Neither of those things are true, right? But the narrative as it stands today is toxic. There's no way we can have a sensible debate if we are talking in those terms. Details matter. Details really matter. And at the high level, you've got at least two problems to solve. You've got the access to end-to-end encrypted services, real-time services. And on the other side, you've got access to seized devices. They are totally different problems. They have totally different technical constraints. They have totally different policy constraints, totally different human rights invasion constraints. So let's be honest about that, and let's try and solve one of the easy ones first rather than trying to solve everything at the same time. Details really matter. I'm going to say that a few times, by the way. So there's a big difference between a seized iPhone 8 and a seized cheap Android device you bought off eBay. One of them's got a well-understood hardware security module that stores the keys and can't do anything for you. The other one probably sticks the key in clear in memory. Right, so let's be honest about that. Let's talk about the details of what we're talking about, so that we can understand the technical solution space that we've got. Details really matter. You know, what you're asking a service to do depends on that service. So if you start comparing all end-to-end encrypted chat services at the meta level, and you say, what are the commonalities? You end up saying, oh, I've got a key exchange and I've got some symmetric crypto. At that point, there's not really much to talk about. Because any solution, if you've just got those two things to work with, is going to be silly. And we'll get to silly solutions in a minute. And details are really important, because what is sufficient? So if you're talking about, for example, seized device access, do you want to get to a place where law enforcement can push a magic button and the entire contents of that phone are available, or do you want to get back to password guessing? Because the constraints and the policy implications are totally different for those things. Okay, hold the laugh, okay, please. UK government strongly supports crypto. Well done, you did pretty well. That's not bad. I know some of the things that we have said in the past don't necessarily sound like it, but genuinely, from a policy perspective, UK government does not want to balk the internet. My director, Jeremy Fleming, so director of GCHQ, last Sunday put an op-ed out in the Sunday Times, you know, a relatively well-respected publication, where he said, can't remember the exact words, we don't want solutions that require skeleton keys, because we couldn't get anybody to understand what key escrow was, or back doors. So he's gone on record saying, we don't want key escrow. Okay. That's published on the GCHQ website. If you want to have a look, there's all sorts of other things in there, but there's one paragraph that's relevant to this. We don't want martini access. Please tell me everybody saw the martini advert in the 90s. Any time, any place, anywhere. So we don't want that. We don't think that's relevant to this discussion. Any access needs to involve the service provider at every position. Because if it doesn't, it scales. And if you have a solution that scales, you can turn it from, I'm after Danny's device, to something that works more globally. And if you have that, Cindy will come and break my ankles. And rightly so. So we need to talk about very specifics of the details so that we can show it doesn't scale. And remember, security is not a binary property. It's not that systems are completely secure today, and if you tweak them a little bit, systems become completely insecure. It's a continuum, and it's about the different attack models and the different work factors that are involved, and we should be honest about that. We're not going from something completely secure to something completely insecure. You're changing characteristics, sure, but let's be honest about it, so at least then we can help the public better decide where they want that slider to be. These things are not idealized crypto systems. Right? They're not academic idealized crypto systems. They are products that billions of people use every day. And people are people, and people forget their passwords, and people lose their phones, and people change their SIMs, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. People don't want to lose 20 years of photos. And so these things all have recovery, usability, backup systems that, as they exist today, can be used to either mitigate the need for an exceptional access system or become part of it. So if you're repurposing some of the things that are already there, you're stepping back away from, let's balk the end-to-end encryption. These things also have implicit trust models. So regardless of whether you like it or not, you're putting some trust in a number of parties in a value chain in order to send your WhatsApp message. Yeah? You've got the people who write the code, you've got the people who run their dev network, you've got the people who run their signing infrastructure, you've got whoever runs the app store, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then depending on which device you've got, you may or may not have three or four different OEMs that contribute to the device stack. And so one of the things we should be honest about is what's the current trust model today between an end user and the stack of developers and operators who they have to trust in order to get this end-to-end security. We think, and this is in Jeremy's op-ed, there's a small number of principles that you could use to talk about these systems, you know, potential exceptional access solutions, in a way that people can understand. So ignore the language. Don't get hung up on the language. Think about the concepts behind this. So at the moment, we're saying things like, we will only ask for access when it is absolutely necessary, and we will ask in the least intrusive way. Right? And we think the Investigatory Powers Act in the UK is the gold standard for transparency and oversight in terms of surveillance law. We can debate that later on, but there is a lot of protection in that. We want to say there is no single solution, but similarly, we want to say we don't want key escrow. Right? Say that up front, elephant in the room, done. We don't want it. It's a stupid idea. You're not going to get 100% access 100% of the time to 100% of the services. But the time when you cannot get any access should be minimized. Investigative models are going to have to evolve. And that's got nothing really to do with encryption. Just as technology changes, investigative models have to change. Because you can't, even if you could get all the content, you couldn't consume it. But intercepting it is going to get much harder as you go to 5G type architectures, as you go to IPv6, identifying your target gets much harder. Don't change that trust relationship that I alluded to. So don't fundamentally change the level of trust you have to put in the vendors that you already trust. And then something about transparency. And this is a really hard one because transparency means different things to different people in different countries. So in the UK, surveillance orders always remain secret. They don't in every country. And so if you say transparency in the UK, it's about volumes, it's about sources, that sort of thing. In the US, it may be actual targets. But let's at least start to have that debate and talk about what a transparency mechanism might look like so you can understand how many times a particular solution's been used. We also can't talk about this problem in isolation. So there's a beginning of a movement to say, forget all of this, just go after the individual endpoints. I think that's got some pretty horrendous second-order effects. So on one hand, you're saying, oh, governments, every time you find a zero day, you must report it to the vendor. But on the other hand, you're saying, but we're not going to create any kind of audited, well-managed solution to help you get exceptional access. You have to go after the endpoints using the vulnerabilities we've just told you to report. That doesn't make sense. That's not the weird second-order effect. The weird second-order effect is you start to build a market for people selling vulnerabilities and exploits. There lies madness. We've spent years in the Vassanar Export Control Group trying to control vulnerabilities and exploits from export just because that market generates a very, very odd set of behaviors in researchers, in vendors, and in others. As an example, and this is a very, very high-level 40-second example of the sorts of things we're talking about in terms of solutions, it's things like group chat and group messaging. So if you think about how most of these services work, the vendor involved is working with the devices to pass identities and keys out. add an extra one. Right? So you've got a real physical device that gets an extra copy of the end-to-end encrypted stuff. That doesn't scale, which is good. It has to have the vendor involved, which is good. And it doesn't break the end-to-end crypto. If instead of talking about walking crypto, you're talking about suppressing a dialogue box, that's a different conversation. You might disagree that there is a difference in policy terms. That's fine. From a technical point of view, it's very different. And on that, I'll finish. Thank you very much.
Next, we have Jim Baker, former general counsel at the FBI, a colleague of mine in the Obama administration.
Jim was responsible, thank you, Josh, for leading a lot of the work of the FBI on this question during his time there. He's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the Lawfare Institute. And really glad you could be here, Jim.
I'm a mere visiting fellow at both of those institutions, so I don't want to get out of line with folks there. So anyway, thank you, Danny, and to the panel and to all of you for showing up on a Sunday morning to talk about this topic. So I'd like to throw out a few different points. I agree with much of what Ian just said, and I'll try to amplify a little bit and give a bit of a U.S. government perspective, although obviously I'm not speaking for the U.S. government anymore, nor the FBI, but to try to flesh out some of those points, which I think are valid, and then critique those a bit as well as we go here. So one of the things that I just, you know, for the audience, I thought just to throw out with respect to policy and expectations over the next year or two, I don't see any realistic possibility that there will be legislation on this topic in 2018, period, full stop. There won't be. And I would expect that the same would be the case for 2019. If you're thinking that legislation is around the corner, I mean, it's theoretically possible. I just don't see it. Of course, the wild card in that comment and the wild card that has been in existence throughout this whole debate really is that if there is some very significant attack and the government can attribute it to an issue, let's just say, with respect to encryption. Like, we were trying to investigate, you know, this particular terrorist, and he was using an end-to-end encrypted system, and we knew it, and we were trying to get at it, and we failed, and then all of a sudden there's a horrendous attack. I mean, that is a wild card in this debate that would change things dramatically and would, I think, result in some type of legislation that would be enacted very quickly. And so one of the things that I think a number of us who've been working on this for literally for years, decades, have been trying to do is to try to get smart people together to try to lay out a generalized framework for solving this problem in some way that is not under the gun like that, so to speak, where we can discuss these issues, have an honest debate, try to figure out whether there's a way forward, and do that without the pressure of trying to act quickly in response to some type of horrific attack. So I urge you to think about this and to invest your efforts and talents in trying to help move this debate forward with that in mind. With respect to that, I guess I would say I think that people believe, at least now, that law enforcement and national security authorities, well, I will refer to generally public safety officials, that public safety officials actually do face a real problem in this area. There are devices, there are services that are relevant to ongoing investigations, relevant to ongoing foreign intelligence collection, that I think most folks would agree is legitimate. Just let's imagine that there's a category that fits, there are examples in that category for the moment, which I submit to you that there are. But this is a real problem. This actually is a problem that hinders appropriate law enforcement, national security activities, and slows down or makes more difficult or more risky legitimate investigations. It is a real problem. I admit to you completely that the officials in the United States have not been able to quantify the scope of that problem effectively. And indeed, at the FBI, we tried. I myself spoke and gave publicly used facts and figures that we had collected. Turns out they're wrong for a variety of reasons that are still being looked at. But the basic idea is that it is a problem that the government has not yet quantified in a way that's persuasive. Part of that is that it's difficult to quantify because law enforcement agents, national security officials, are folks who are under tremendous pressure to move through a large number of investigations quickly to act in a very agile way. And when they know that a particular service or a particular type of device is not going to be accessible, they don't waste their time going to get a lawful process for that type of device. They just don't do it. They move on to other things. And so that is a data point that doesn't exist, that is hard to collect. And so we couldn't when I was in the government, exactly articulate how that shows up, how that impacts what we're doing. So anyway, it's hard to quantify, and we've done a bad job of quantifying that which we actually can quantify. So anyway, we should take full responsibility for that. Law enforcement, public safety officials, the government has not come up with a viable technical solution to address this problem, period. I think that part of the difficulty there is that, as Danny was saying, this, if you're really actually trying to deal with this problem, you need to deal with it from a 360-degree perspective. So I would say there is a public safety issue, but there are cybersecurity issues. There are issues with respect to civil rights and civil liberties. There are issues with respect to human rights around the world. There are issues with maintaining the innovation culture that we have in this industry. There are issues with maintaining the competitiveness of, at least here, U.S. industries, right? And if you're not taking into consideration all of those factors and various parts of the folks, or various sectors of the folks involved in this debate, I think sometimes underemphasize various parts of that 360-degree world, then you're just not going to come up with something that's going to work. You're not going to come up with a solution that's going to be viable. And the reason this is a hard problem is because it is so complicated in those various ways. And nobody's really figured out how to address all those simultaneously in a way that is persuasive to all the stakeholders, or at least the majority of them. I think on various aspects of this, there are going to be people who simply don't like certain types of solutions and will never accept a risk-based model where you're trying to balance these various different things. But in any event, we just collectively have not come up with a solution that the majority of folks would accept. I would imagine that the folks in this audience and the folks listening to this would really want the government to be the one that comes up with the technical solution. I don't think that is a good idea. I don't think that's really the government's responsibility to come up with a technical solution. I don't think that's what society would really want. I think it is something that a variety of folks, the industry that is involved in manufacturing these products that are at issue, need to be involved in that. And there needs to be sufficient transparency so that the public has confidence that their rights are being protected. And so I don't think it's the government's job to actually come up with a technical solution, but we can have that discussion. And I also don't think it's something that at least the folks at this conference would really want. All of these issues and our failure to really find a solution to this problem does have real-world impacts. There are, and I would just ask folks to think about this as they think about this debate, there are real victims of crimes. There are real victims of terrorist attacks. And they're human beings, just like all of us. And it's when you are in law enforcement, when you're working in national security, you feel that weight significantly. And so it's imperative that we figure out a way to solve this for the people who have been victims of crimes and who are going to be the victims in the future. So encryption that protects all of us and is hugely valuable and that we all want, and I'll talk about that in one second, it also does have costs. And I think we have to recognize that somebody, some human beings, are going to pay that cost. So it's important to think about that, and I think that should hopefully motivate all of us to find a way to find a solution to this. Okay, I do think that, I am concerned, I guess I would say, and think that sometimes public safety officials take too narrow of a view with respect to what it is they're trying to do. So yes, in individual cases, when you're trying to solve a crime and you've got a phone, the smartphone that you can't get into because of encryption, that's extremely frustrating. And it drives people crazy when they're trying to investigate. And they believe legitimately that there's relevant evidence on that phone. They get a warrant, which is what we all require, at least in the United States. And you get the warrant, you get the you get the phone, you have physical possession of it, but you still can't get in. That's extremely frustrating. But we do need to think about encryption broadly. We do need to think about the role and responsibility of public safety officials with respect to all of society. And we do have an obligation to protect our data, our communications, especially in an era when, let's just say, that certain devices that might be somewhat questionable are making their way into the telecommunications infrastructure of the world, that we might have less confidence that those are secure communications. And so I think public safety officials need to think about that. We also do need to think about the implications of this in terms of protecting our data, because as many of the folks here know, there are malicious cyber actors who are looting the personally identifiable information of a lot of people. They're doing that for a lot of reasons to provide benefits to them in immediate present, but also long-term, I think that has implications for the appetite that AI-related technologies have for big data and the implications of feeding AI with big data. And I think we just need to do a better job of protecting all that, and I think public safety officials need to think broadly about their responsibilities in that regard.
So we have Sven Herbig, who's with the New Responsibilities Foundation in Berlin and has been studying both German government policy and broader questions in this area. So please, Sven, go ahead.
Thank you, Danny. Good morning to all of you. The reason why I want to talk about German encryption policies today is because together with the UK and with France, Germany is driving cybersecurity and privacy policies across the European Union. Best practices from those countries have been adopted in other countries in the European Union, so it's a focal point in the EU. And it's also, contrary to other examples, a very, very strong focus on encryption policies for a long time without going out of the way for law enforcement and intelligence community. So 28 years ago, 1991, Germany separated crypto makers from crypto breakers and established their own institution, the German National Cybersecurity Agency, which is until now only focused on defensive measures. There's no government hacking there happening there. There's no investigations happening there. There's just pure encryption research, certifications, IT security guidelines, and so on and so far. And they are based within the Ministry of Interior, outside of the military. It's a very, if you want, a very pure agency when it comes to encryption policy. 8 years later, in 1999, the German government issued the crypto principles. They're a bit longer, but there's two aspects that are very important to the discussion right now. One is it reaffirms that the government will uphold strong encryption, do not put backdoors in there, do not produce or ask companies to produce skeleton keys, and so on and so far. At the same time, acknowledging that there might in the future be legitimate interest of law enforcement and intelligence agencies to access information that are on encrypted devices. And to balance those scales is basically the bottom line of the German government policy. These crypto principles, even though passed in 1999, have been reaffirmed a couple of times by the German government, latest in 2017, so they are still standing by it. In 2009, Germany passed legal amendments which put into law how law enforcement and intelligence agencies are allowed and under what circumstances they are allowed to conduct endpoint exploitation or government hacking or law enforcement hacking. This decision was challenged in the Supreme Court, and those who challenged it won to the majority of it. The legal amendments were passed, but additional safeguards were put into law, so that the safeguards right now are pretty high for law enforcement agencies to conduct government hacking. That led to two developments. One is the government started to develop their own malware because they couldn't buy anything off the shelf, because everything that was off the shelf commercial would violate the strong safeguards that the Supreme Court put on government hacking. The second part is that the agents in the field actually are looking for workarounds to not conduct government hacking because the safeguards and the paperwork is so much that they don't want to conduct it. It's just too much work for them. In 2014, the German government declared digitalization as a priority. Well, pretty late, but well, Germany. And they put in there not so much about security, but there was one thing that stood out and that's still cited today, which was to make Germany the crypto country or the encryption country number one in the world. That's a very bold statement. It resulted, amongst other things, in creating the Germany Mail. I don't want to go into details because it failed horribly, but well, it was an interesting concept. It's still kind of kept alive because no one wants to admit it was a failure, but it's a failure, no one is using that. But that shows how high encryption is on the government agenda. In 2017, last year, there were two very important developments. The first development was that the government passed amendments again for endpoint exploitation, government hacking, which allows government agencies to conduct it in a more variety of cases, now also including certain kinds of gambling and money laundering, where law enforcement agencies are now allowed to conduct government hacking. At the same time, we set something up that other countries, I think, also would like to have. They set up a central authority or central agency which deals with all research pertaining to government hacking. So that agency basically looks for vulnerabilities, buys vulnerabilities, buys tools, develops tools, and so on and so far, and then provides them to the law enforcement and intelligence community with services to enable them to conduct government hacking. It's a central, basically a central service agency for all things government hacking. This year, there were already two additional cases filed in the Supreme Court on that new amendment, one from the private sector, one from the civil society, challenging again the constitutionality of the new legal amendment for government hacking. And on the other hand, the German government is now writing a concept to establish a German vulnerabilities equities process, which should allow German government to find and buy zero-day vulnerabilities and somehow bring them into a process where at the end of the day they might be able to retain them and not disclose them to the vendor and then put them in their malware or use them in government hacking operations. Right now, the government, excluding foreign intelligence and military, is holding zero-day vulnerabilities. That has been affirmed by the government a couple of weeks back. So where does it lead us in Germany? First, I don't think, honestly, I mean, I work for the government, I'm now out of the government, but I can honestly tell you there's no doubt about Germany's strong commitment to encryption and not putting backdoors or skeleton keys. It was never on the agenda. It will never be on the agenda in the next couple of years. So we are good on that part. Of course, government agencies have to conduct their investigations. They have legitimate interest in doing so. And they are looking for other ways to get to the information. One way, of course, is endpoint exploitation, government hacking. But as I said, the legal safeguards for government hacking in Germany are quite prohibitive from the perspective of the agencies. So they are looking also for other workarounds to get through the information. One case that we publicly know already was affiliated with the Telegram messenger, where they were adding additional devices to group chats so that the law enforcement agencies were able to monitor the conversations in those group chats without needing a backdoor, without needing to conduct, endpoint exploitation. It was more kind of an encryption workaround, if you will. Government hacking doesn't only have very strong legal safeguards in Germany. On top of that, our civil society and our private sector is still challenging the already existing strong and tight safeguards in the Supreme Court, and I guess it looks quite favorable that these safeguards will be even tightened when the Supreme Court reaches a decision, but which I don't think will be this year. Since 2009, when government hacking was allowed, so it's like 10 years now, we have only seen a low two-digit number of actually conducted government hacking operations, which is, not really a lot. And despite all those very strong safeguards and limitations and, if you want, a very prohibitive field to conduct government hacking and getting to those information, contrary to a presidential tweet that appeared a couple of weeks ago, Germany is a very safe country. It's not like crime is running rampant and we can't access the details on phones and we can't persecute those crimes. We can. We have a lot of workarounds. For example, one law, German law, actually allows law enforcement agencies, when they obtain a warrant, to access your analog mailbox, your letters. But this law is also used to access your email inbox. And if you compare the difference of information that you have lying around in your email inbox and in your regular inbox, it's easy to know that they can access information without a weakening encryption, without government hacking, but using other more traditional workarounds to get to the information they actually want to have. And then the last note is, we had two very huge national security failures in the last 5 years. One was a terrorist attack, one was a rightist terrorist group in Germany. In both cases, the German security agencies failed with their investigations, people died. And in both cases, the government agencies had more than enough information to stop those crimes, to stop them from happening, but they failed to do so because of a lack of communication and information sharing and the agencies working together. It was not because they couldn't hack into systems, because they couldn't access information on encrypted iPhones or whatever. It was a failure on communication, coordination, and cooperation. It was not a failure of what we might think encrypted information. And on that note, I'll leave you 50 more seconds, Danny.
Fantastic. Next, we have Adam Engel. Adam is with the Australian government, Department of Home Affairs, and has been working very hard putting together the Australian government's new legislative proposal. So we're really happy to have you and it hot off the presses. Thanks.
Thanks, Danny. As Danny said, I'm Adam. I work for the Department of Home Affairs in the National Security Policy branch there. So we deal with Australia's national security policy legislative approach. My team specifically deals with the reforms to kind of address the challenges associated with ubiquitous encryption. And we released a draft proposal on Tuesday. So it is hot off the press. It's been a busy week fielding questions and receiving abuse. We do welcome constructive comments. We have already consulted with some industry participants, domestic and foreign, including kind of Silicon Valley providers, and we will be making further amendments in response to their concerns. We really do want to get this right, and it is in a consultation phase at the moment, so I do encourage you to consider the legislation and give us feedback on this email addresses and the like on the publicly available materials. It's certainly not consultation for the sake of consultation. But given that it was only released on Tuesday, I will assume you haven't either read it or not read all 179 pages of it. It doesn't solve the problem, but it does help, at least from an Australian government perspective. So basically, the bill does three things. It introduces modern computer access powers to allow remote and covert searches of devices, so similar framework to what Sven was talking about before. This is to facilitate access to unencrypted content at an endpoint and modernize warrant processes. The Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, so our domestic security agency, already has these powers, so they're not new from an Australian context. Second aspect is it bolsters traditional search and seizures powers by increasing the penalties for not complying with a judicial order for access. So that's a enhancing traditional access methods overtly. And the third and probably the most controversial aspect of it is it establishes a new regime for agencies to request industry assistance from the telecommunications industry. So given the time, I'll focus on that aspect. It operates on that, the industry assistance framework, at least, and more broadly the bill, operates on three key principles. The first one is that lawful proportionate access to communications is necessary for authorities to effectively discharge their legitimate functions. And you've heard that from many of the panelists here today. I mean, we believe this is a reasonable premise. Where a compelling public need exists, as demonstrated by a warrant, for example, governments should be able to compel access to otherwise private information. The fact that electronic communications increasingly facilitate criminal conduct and are used to coordinate illicit activity makes this all the more important. It's great that we're able to make information more secure, but that this isn't necessarily an argument that agencies should lose appropriate access. It's more nuanced than that. Whether agencies should be able to overcome protections will go to the circumstances, considerations of proportionality, reasonableness, and the impact of any access method on the broader security of third-party communications. And we acknowledge that it's critical that access to private communications remains subject to underlying warrant protections. I mean, a rule of law country has a strong judiciary, and in all but the most exceptional circumstances, the ability to undertake surveillance on a target should be approved by a third party and subject to appropriate limitations. There's also a role of judicial review. So in providers who are subject to access orders or people who suspect they're a subject of legal surveillance have a revenue to challenge, an avenue to challenge those things. So new methods of access, like the computer access warrants I just said, they're part of the solution but not the complete solution. And to have a meaningful answer, we really need to bring along industry. So this first point, that lawful access is necessary, it's important, because if we don't accept the proposition that law enforcement has a right to collect private information for evidential and intelligence purposes, then any kind of access is criticised. And we're finding that right now. I mean, it's whether it's a back door, a front door, a side door, it's all illegitimate if you don't accept that first premise. So the second premise is that in this new age, a broad range of organizations should help provide access in the same way that traditional domestic carriers have been for a long time. So traditional telcos in Australia have long had a reasonable assistance obligation, and we've got quite mature and established relationships with our domestic carriers. Agencies frequently go for them to help, and they've got a legislative obligation they can point to as the grounds for that assistance. And while the fear of going dark in the 1990s didn't eventuate, the proliferation of data and technology has given law enforcement new source information. All throughout that period, border assistance from domestic industry was critical to many investigations. And the role of these providers, these domestic providers, is diminishing. They remain the backbone of the network, for sure, but new devices and services are increasingly being provided offshore. It's now easier to deliver communications to users in a country with little or no infrastructure in that country, and legislation needs to be technologically neutral to accurately reflect the proliferation of communication service technologies and these providers. So from Australian government's perspective, companies that supply services or devices in Australia should have an obligation to assist domestic agencies where their products are used to facilitate illegal conduct. Do these offshore entities have less of an obligation than domestic providers? What is the nature of that obligation? Their details need to be worked out, but I think the playing field needs to be leveled between domestic and offshore industry, where those offshore industries have a role in a country's jurisdiction. The third principle that I'll go to is that assistance has its limits. Encryption and other forms of electronic communications are valuable cybersecurity tools, and governments should not undermine the security of innocent third parties. This means no backdoors. I know some of you might have heard our Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull say that the laws of mathematics don't apply in Australia. They very much do. And this legislation reflects that. We don't want to undermine security. We don't want to undermine the laws of mathematics. The value of encryption is clear to everyone. It secures citizens' industry and government information. If efforts to facilitate access means that security of a particular form of electronic protection, like encryption, or say like password rate limits, will be materially compromised, that's a risk that the Australian government doesn't want to take and cannot take under the new laws. However, whether there is a material risk will turn on the circumstances in question, and we need to provide flexibility to allow people to determine whether risk exists and whether the access method does compromise that. So we want to have the means to approach industry with a problem, and if they can reasonably assist without undermining wholesale security, then they'll be expected to do that. So how do we give effect to these three principles in the bill? Well, the first one is what we call the no back doors provision. So this is in, I don't know whether you remember this, but section 317ZG of the legislation, and what it does introduce is a very firm prohibition on building or implementing a systemic weakness into a form of electronic protection. And we clarify in that provision that includes the requirement to build a decryption capability, and it provides anything that would actually make forms of encryption or authentication less effective. And in the explanatory materials to the bill, we make it clear that we won't legislate for the power to force redesigns on methods of encryption or other forms of electronic protection, so key escrow, all that kind of stuff, that's out. However, the key word is systemic, and I think what we're trying to really emphasise is that targeted particular access that won't undermine third-party security, that is a legitimate thing. Whether you can do that and how you can do that's really left up to government and industry to negotiate and work out. You still need a warrant. So access to an investigation, assistance with an investigation is distinct from accessing the private content of data or communications. So the access itself, that remains governed by Australia's existing warranted legislation with requirements for a judiciary or a third party to actually approve that access. The assistance is a distinct part. We actually don't have warrants with extraterritorial effect as well. So people that are kind of saying, well, these new powers will allow them to require Facebook to hand over encrypted content, that's just not accurate. Our laws, our warrants for telecommunications interception and content, they're limited to actually being served on domestic carriers. We don't have a Cloud Act signatory or anything like that that would allow us to overcome the mutual assistance legal process as it stands. So we actually still undertake requests through the mutual legal assistance process. I think a key principle is that the bill is trying to be technologically neutral. In the rapidly evolving era, the law needs to be adaptive and suitable for the technology that comes along. We haven't set out exactly how industry should help. I think, as some of my panelists said, government shouldn't be setting the technical means to achieve this. It really should be a negotiation between government and industry should knows their systems the best, and they should be providing the solutions. And they should be providing the solutions and the assistance. They should be doing all this subject to kind of some global safeguards and global considerations of reasonable proportionality, no systemic weaknesses, no undermining encryption. But we don't want to prescribe exact methods of assistance, because really it's going to turn on circumstances and be the benefit of a productive relationship between government and industry. And that's what the bill is. It's a framework for cooperation. It's not trying to force. Well, we're able to have coercive powers in there, but the real intent of it is to provide a frame of cooperation, a legal mandate for cooperation. We've tried to take a graduated approach there, which has voluntary elements. It's got really expectations that if you're able to assist, you can, and where you can't, we want to help you. And we don't want to put anyone at a commercial loss as well. So we have designed some quite flexible compensation mechanisms, and I think that's me done.
Adam, thanks very much. We've had the benefit of the perspectives of four leading governments around the globe that are setting the tone in many ways. And now, to give us perspective on all of that, we have Cindy Cohen, who's the Executive Director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Many of you know EFF. I'm a proud alum of EFF, and really EFF has been a kind of a sustained voice for civil liberties and user interest in the internet environment. So we're really happy to have you. Cindy.
All right, now for something somewhat different. I'm here because you guys are the global brain trust around encryption technologies. And my goal here is to convince you to join us in making the internet safer and resist the temptation to solve the government's problem of making sure that we're not as safe. And I want to start with a simple fact. Digital security is hard, really hard, and we're failing at it massively and dramatically, and there's no end in sight. From the growth in identity theft to attacks that threaten our very self-government and democracies, from malware attacks on democracy activists around the world to malware attacks on hospitals, to spouseware tools that track women as they seek shelter from domestic abusers, to election systems that are built out of baling wire and string, we're failing in making our digital world secure. We're at a time when that lack of basic security built into the guts of the early internet, something that was created in part because of pressure from the intelligence agencies to not build a secure internet, is really coming home to roost, and it's causing tremendous, I would argue, nation-risking harm. We're talking about real victims here, real victims from the lack of security in the tools that we've built, real human beings who suffer real harm as a result of the lack of digital security in our world. I think it should be all hands on deck to fix this, encrypt the web, secure our data, whether it's at risk or in transit, harden and build better systems to fix the security holes that are inevitable in software-based systems that are trying to patch a broken underlying infrastructure, and make sure that everything gets fixed as quickly as possible. Governments should be shouldering their responsibility for public safety by leading and incentivizing digital security for their increasingly vulnerable citizens, the humans that increasingly rely on the network, who are often completely absent from these conversations that talk about technologists and talk about companies and talk about government's needs without actually talking about all the rest of us. I appreciate getting the opportunity to represent the rest of us at this conversation, at least. The government should be incentivizing building systems of trust. Everyone here knows that secure systems depend on trust, and that when that trust is weakened, the whole thing falls apart. But they're not. There's been no significant effort to make the rest of us more secure, even as we're pushed into a world where we need the network for more and more things. It's left groups like EFF to try to encrypt the web, with help from Mozilla and a few others. It's left to groups like Tor to try to create secure web browsing. It's left to people like Ian Goldberg and Moxie Marlinspike to build secure chat. The gap between academic thinking and tools that the rest of us can use remains as big as it was when I started in the 1990s trying to free up encryption from government control. But it's worse. Instead of government-spurred and supported efforts to build a more secure network and the devices and the things that rely on it, we have proposals like these, which are both disingenuous and dangerous, and which attack trust rather than build it. We have the FBI trying to strong-arm Apple into dumbing down its security, and apparently, in this last, as just came true, trying to strong-arm Facebook into dumbing down Messenger. Basically, the proposals we've seen all involve some quite clever ways to say we support strong crypto while still undermining the very reason the rest of us actually want it. Let's not kid ourselves. While everyone in this room loves math and applied math and cryptography, the rest of us want what the Ninth Circuit called encryption's bounty, the security that we get when cryptography is placed properly. The Ninth Circuit decision in Bernstein, I dance here, so I do a shout out to the work we did together in the 90s. What's going on? I see this as fundamentally a difference in viewpoint. From the people who want to keep us secure in the first place to the people who have a forensic goal of trying to solve crimes after they happen. And these two approaches are in fundamental tension. You either get to have a secure lock on your house, or your lock is insecure so that the cops can come in later if it turns out you're a robber. The approaches offered by the government put these two things in tension and continue to. And then they'll say, well, we don't want key escrow, or we don't want strong encryption, but you know, it's okay because we're going to build a hole underneath your house with a thing that comes up and, you know, secretly join your conversations when you and secretly add additional ghost devices to your key ring as a way of saying that they support strong encryption while routing around the very reason that we want it. So no surprise, EFF is opposed to both the UK Investigatory Powers Act and the related work that they're doing, and the recent Australian proposal, although I admit we're still digesting the big document. In both, we see a stunning lack of transparency and accountability and an unfounded and, frankly, unproven trust in the idea that they can devise weaknesses and workarounds that only they can use and nobody else will ever discover and it won't leak out. And they, I think, invent a not-our-job approach to keeping the rest of us safe and recognizing the pressures that they are putting on technologists if they demand access for them and expect them to resist the same demands from people with more nefarious goals. So it's true that both the Australian approach and the UK approach promise no back doors. But honestly, with just a few days of thinking about it, my clever lawyers have figured out many ways that you can get the effect of a back door without actually having it. We'll be having those conversations more deeply. Australia says it won't introduce new vulnerabilities, but they're perfectly willing to get vulnerabilities from everyone else. And remember, of course, we're talking about the Five Eyes process where the governments share information and techniques with each other. They work together. And both the Australian and the UK approach, although slightly different in the details, approach this idea of a technical capability notice, which means that the government shows up and has a secret, one-sided demand that says that you need to find a way in to access the plain text of information that you have. The Australian one is especially concerning to us because it allows them to reach anybody in the thing. So you don't have to go to the corporate headquarters. You can go to the systems administrators. You can go to the release people. You can go to almost anyone in the context of Internet of Things. We know how easily it is to turn those things into surveillance devices. And demand that that person undermine the security of the tool that they are participating in. Well, what does that do to trust? It means inside a corporation, the corporate heads can't tell whether all of their staffers are actually working for them or working for the government. It means that people can't trust their coworkers. It means that people can't trust that they have to trust not just the corporate promises, but every single person who works in the corporation before they can trust that they should take that download and that upgrade and fix that security hole. And it means staffers don't know either. It means that people can easily, I suspect, pretend to be working on secret government orders when they're not. This is corrosive. It's dangerous and bad. And I think that the governments need to rethink these things. Australia says, well, we don't have extraterritorial application now, but they have this interesting thing that says domestic legal frameworks need to mature in order to make this work. This, to me, is troubling. And I do think that the argument that they're not doing extraterritorial, I don't want to get into deep law with you guys, but I think there are some big holes there. But what are their justifications? And let me just spend a second on those. You know, first is, well, don't worry, we'll only use this for good. There are bad guys out there, and we need to do that. But if you build it for good guys, I think Tim Cook pointed out very clearly in the Apple versus FBI thing, how do you resist when the bad guys come and say, we want some of that sauce too? It puts companies in a very difficult position. It puts technologists in an even worse position because they don't have corporate lawyers to help support them. They assume that nothing's going to leak and that nothing's going to be independently discovered. But a RAND study, which is somewhat controversial, says that up to 10% of vulnerabilities get separately discovered within a year. So 10 years, all found. And then they both embrace legal hacking and broader, much broader authorities for legal hacking. You know, Australia, the UK says anyone can do legal hacking. Australia says only a service provider can be required to do help with legal hacking. But we've seen that that's a very, very broad definition and could include every website you visit. Well, I only have a few seconds left, but I want to talk a second about U.S. law. U.S. constitutional law is based, honest foremost, at limiting the government in what it can do. Technical capability has never been a limit on what the U.S. government, has never been the only limit on what the government can do. And we shouldn't embrace that now. That's the heart of American law. So if the government can't solve a crime because it doesn't have a particular power, that's exactly what the U.S. Constitution says should be the end result if the technique and the technologies that they want to do it with violate people's rights. So we've got First Amendment issues, which is requiring people to write code that they don't want to write. We've got Fourth Amendment issues involving search and seizure, both of which are implicated by these plans. We've got due process, the right to confront your accusers and see the evidence arrayed against you, all of which at risk in this proposition that the government is making to you to help them solve this problem. Come join us. Come help make the internet safer. Come build a more trustworthy internet with us. And resist the temptation that just because the government has said, here's a really hard problem, will you help us solve it, that your job is to do it. Thank you.
I want to just start with one or two questions for the panel. To begin with, we've heard, I think, two somewhat different approaches from governments. The first approach I'll characterize as the kind of unreconstructed U.S. government approach in which there was an effort to say, well, just solve this problem. Just, you know, come up with some whiz-bang technical solution that gets law enforcement what it needs. And I'm not going to make Jim defend that unreconstructed approach. And then we have, I think, a more nuanced approach in the form of the UK law and the proposed Australian law, which admittedly we're all still digesting, which goes meta on the problem in a certain way, if you will, and gives governments authority to make certain kinds of requirements on technology providers, but provides some limits and some constraints that those requirements have to satisfy. One of which, as both Ian and Adam suggested, is that any technical capacity, any exceptional access capacity, would have to be, I think the word in the UK law is technically practicable, which I think is thought to include some notion of security. And the Australian law goes a little further. It says you can't compromise the security of the system overall. And I want to ask the panel for its thoughts about, given that we have such a law in the UK, we may have such a law in Australia, how would that work? How would, given some government request for some kind of exceptional access, how would you actually evaluate whether a given requirement has a systemic weakness or not? And to Cindy's point, what would be necessary to make that set of determinations yield a result that would be regarded as broadly trustworthy, if that's possible?
Assume, for the sake of argument, we've got a well-defined outcome in mind. which isn't always the case in this stuff. In the UK, the way it works is the Secretary of State responsible will go and say, right, I want to get Ian's Honest Messaging Inc. to do this thing, this capability. Before anything happens, that has to go through the Judicial Commissioner. So the Investigatory Powers Commissioner, who is a High Court judge, will have to have a view on that as well. And it's a double lock. So if they don't both agree, nothing happens. Next thing is they then have to go and consult with the target of this notice. So the company, so they come to Ian's Honest Messaging and say, hey, we want to do this. There's a discussion about whether what's reasonable and practical and all that sort of thing. And in the end, you assume, for the sake of the discussion, the government believes there is a reasonable and practical solution to be done. Assuming both the judge and the Secretary of State still agree, that notice is served. One of two things happens. The company goes, yeah, all right, that makes sense, and does it. Or the company goes, actually, no, we don't agree. And it gets pushed back to something called the Technical Advisory Board, which is independent and technical, which we've never really had before, which will take a judgment on whether it is reasonable, practical, and whether it has unintended side effects, that sort of thing. If the Technical Advisory Board doesn't agree that it's reasonable, practical, and safe, it doesn't get done. And so you've got the double lock on the Judicial Commissioner and the Secretary of State both having to agree that it's a reasonable thing to ask in the first place, consultation with the company, and it has to be the company. It's not, in the UK, it is absolutely not permissible to serve an order on a random person. It has to be someone in either a telecoms or postal operator, and has to be somebody with the right kind of seniority and power. The big change in the UK from the last set of legislation to this one is the intention to make the legislation more understandable. So we've brought everything into one place and try to talk about it in a way that people can foresee what the intent is. So you can foresee that these things will happen in this way. As I say, the addition of judicial oversight of all of these things, double lock, and the Technical Advisory Board in order to provide technical support to the Judicial Commissioner, because let's be honest, most 80-year-old judges don't understand crypto. So how do you fix that? That's what we're trying to do in the UK. The belief is that is one of the strongest oversight regimes in the world. Discuss.
Right. So I'll just observe, and we'll go to the rest of the panel, but I'll observe that the middle portion of this workshop you might think of as a little bit of a effort to figure out whether there is a way to have a technically well-grounded discussion of various proposals that might themselves become in some way the subject of technical capacity notices. So we're going to figure out whether it's actually what it looks like to actually try to do that in a shorthanded way. Jim.
Thanks, Danny. So I guess in the United States, if I think about the Apple case, for example, we kind of have a double lock situation here in the sense that the government is required. So let's think about the San Bernardino phone. You have the phone of a dead suspect. The government has to go and did go and obtain a warrant under the Fourth Amendment, meeting all of the requirements of the Fourth Amendment, 100%. We obtained the warrant, got that authorization to go into that particular phone. And then we needed, in order to do that, we didn't have the ability technically to do that. And so what we needed to do was go to somebody else, in this case Apple, and obtain their assistance. Apple said no. And so the question was, well, is there a legal mechanism under U.S. law by which the government can require a third party, an innocent third party, to provide assistance to the government? The government's theory was that there is this statute called the All Writs Act that the government thought was sufficient to enable it to obtain an order from a court to require Apple to unlock the phone. Apple disagreed. Litigation ensued. And that's how we solve it. We resolve these questions about whether the law is robust enough to require a third party to do something technical to provide assistance to the government through the courts. That's how we do it. A question that has come up is whether that law, the All Writs Act, or whether the other laws that might be applicable in different related situations with respect to surveillance like Title III or FISA, whether those statutes are robust enough to require a third party to help. And it seems it is not technically resolved as to whether those laws are robust enough, but that is the question. And then the question, I think in front of all of us in the United States is whether we want laws that enable the government to require a third party like that to provide assistance in these circumstances. That's basically what it is. So it's analogous in some ways to these other regimes that we're talking about.
Thanks. Sven?
In Germany, we are quite much in the dark of how the malware is eventually delivered to the phone or to the device of the target of an investigation. One discussion, of course, we had was via spear phishing and the regular tactics that all the criminals use. And the other discussion was where the government agencies were using software from FinSpy, it's a German company. And they developed a tool that can be delivered through requiring the internet service provider to deliver that malware along with something that you're actually looking for. So you want to download like an MP3 player, and the ISP delivers you the MP3 player bundled with the government malware. So we have not seen any of that in the wild, and it has been debated little in Germany. There's no legal grounds for the agencies to actually require ISPs or other service providers to deliver their malware. We're not sure if they have done that anyway in cooperation with those providers, but even though there's like strong legal safeguards and other things like the accountability, the oversight and everything else, we haven't seen anything about requiring other third parties to deliver government malware, and as it's currently also not being debated right now. So,
I'll probably talk about the there's a few aspects of the new industry assistance framework that Australia has, but the most applicable one here is the technical capability notice, blatantly ripped off from the UK legislation. The term, at least, the way the power functions is different, because we can require technical assistance that a provider is already capable of doing, but that would work within their existing premises. So we wouldn't be introducing any flaws, and arguably we can't introduce any flaws in the other power. So the technical capability notices work is it's issued by the Attorney General, who's the first law officer of Australia, so legally qualified, has a mandate for oversight and in integrity. He looks after the Commonwealth Ombudsman, the Intelligence Inspector General, the Intelligence and Security. So these are both integrity agencies. So oversight integrity is part of his or her mandate. He or her must be satisfied that a notice is reasonable, proportionate, practical, and technically feasible. So that idea of technical feasible goes to the idea of security as well. But even more, I suppose, definitively, he can't issue a notice that would undermine security of a system. So attract that prohibition against systemic weaknesses or systemic vulnerabilities. That's very clearly set out in the legislation. But the Attorney General would issue the notice. There's a mandatory consultation period, and arguably to be satisfied that a notice is reasonable, proportionate, practical, technically feasible, consultation would need to occur well before this mandatory consultation period with industry engaged. I just want to clear up something. We actually can't serve technical capability notices on individuals within a corporation. The corporate entity is the endpoint there. So we can't require, say, an employee of Apple to be operating under a secret notice that Apple is ignorant of. It does have the ability to be served on individuals and corporations, but only when those individuals are their own separate entity. So that's something that I'd like to clear up. And if the industry and government would really reach a solution that would enable access, that doesn't go to removing electronic protection and doesn't attract that prohibition against systemic weaknesses and vulnerabilities, if the industry player was mindful to challenge that, there's a very robust judicial review process in Australia. So they can very well go to the courts and determine, argue either this notice is not reasonable, proportionate, technically feasible, practical, or say that it will introduce a systemic vulnerability and therefore is unlawful. So that's how the technical capability notice process will work in Australia. We've kind of relied on that back-end oversight and the existing integrity rather than going through that front-end double log process. But also the way our notices work, they are more limited than what the UK notices can do, because we can't require the removal of electronic protection in our notice. We can't require interception capabilities to be made. We can't require data retention capabilities to be made. So they actually are more limited power, and what they can do is set out explicitly in the primary legislation rather than regulations themselves. So Parliament would be to scrutinise any additional things for a technical capability notice.
Thanks, Adam. Cindy?
Oh, it's fun to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, isn't it? I do want to just say that I appreciate that the effort here is to try to assume that there's a problem and then figure out how one might solve it. But I think that until someone has demonstrated that there's a problem, not with making up numbers, And not with demonstrating, with those other things, then maybe we should spend our time on other things, because there's other things on fire. And I really just feel frustrated that amount of energy is being sent on, at least in the U.S., basically assuming a problem and then trying to figure out how to solve it when the first step of demonstrating that there's a problem hasn't been made. I get held to that proof when I go in front of a court or in front of the public to try to talk about a problem. And I don't think it's too much for the rest of us to ask the governments of the world to come forward with that kind of proof as well. And, you know, sadly, the FBI lied about it. And they also lied about their technical capability in the San Bernardino case. They've gotten trouble with the inspector general around that. And so maybe one hand didn't know what the other hand is doing. But if you're going to ask the rest of us to build something, I think you should get your house in order first. And make the case. In terms of evaluation, the UK system is very new, and we haven't been able to see very many situations go through it. The Australian one's just announced, so it's hard to talk about this, but I will point out that the rubber meets the road in how this stuff gets implemented and not how it's written on paper, and that's been our reality in the US as well. So it's hard, it's a hard thing to talk about. In the U.S., we've seen secrecy pervading these systems. I mean, the San Bernardino case, we only know about it because the government decided to go public with the situation because they thought the situation was so sympathetic that they would win, and were a little surprised, I think, by the fact that most people didn't think they should win that case. There are other cases that have been under seal that we know about, and there's still others that aren't. So in terms of how do we know that there's trust, I think in the United States, the answer is we don't. We don't. We have to trust generally systems that are captured entirely inside the executive agency. The agency that wants the access has all the systems inside of it in terms of accountability, except for maybe running out occasionally and asking a judge who doesn't understand the context a very focused small question. We were instrumental in making sure that the FISA court was able to bring in independent people to have a voice. That was a part of the FISA Amendments Act that EFF championed, and we reached out to former FISA court judges to get that in. We're very happy that that's in there, but we shouldn't kid ourselves. That's the most baby of baby steps and far away from the adversarial process by which we decide other things about due process and law in this country. So I do worry a lot that the history that we've had in the last, 1993, 25 years of encryption policy is one that does not make me confident that we're ever going to be able to trust that the paper that these processes are written on is actually how they work in practice.
So I want to just make one observation, and I'll do this under the advice of Ian and Adam, but as I understand both the UK law and the proposed Australian law, as Ian said, transparency remains a question mark, the question of what kind of transparency there ought to be if there are going to be these technical capacity notices. Right now, my understanding is that as a general rule, the notices certainly are not required to be made public. I do think it puts the technical community and the companies in a pretty awkward position of having to vouch for the behavior of systems that are being offered to the public with features that are not subject to the sort of normal kind of public technical scrutiny that we're used to in the security community. And I give Ian credit for noting that as a question that has to be resolved. I think that, so if, I don't know if I'm missing anything, Ian or Adam.
The intent in the TCNs in the UK is that they are secret unless it is authorized by the government to disclose them. And I agree with Cindy. Now, what's written down on the paper is different to what will actually be implemented. And until that happens, and until you've got actual people who, are they technically competent? Do they hate intelligence agencies enough? All of those sorts of questions need to be answered. I absolutely agree with that. But if you assume for the sake of this small discussion that happens, could you ever consider a government, a competent government, you can argue about such a thing exists, but anyway.
Not a good time for that discussion.
No, it's not, is it? coming out and saying, we want someone like Apple or Google or Facebook to change how their stuff works without telling anybody. So given that most of these companies publish security white papers And there's a massive security research community reverse engineering them to show that they follow those things. If you think a capability is going to stay secret in that situation, you're mad. And so you may as well start off by saying, our assumption should be it will go out for public review, it will go to the community. If you can't defend it, you shouldn't be doing it.
Adam, anything? Thanks, Ian.
Yeah, so the assumption is that the Australian TCNs will remain secret unless disclosed by government. Although we have allowed transparency measures, so Apple, if they were served to TCN, they could publish that in their transparency report. So the companies are very able to publish the statistical information about if they've been subject to these things or not. And I suppose back to Sydney's point about, you know, yes, very good paper, but how does it translate in practice? You know, it is very difficult to work that out in the circumstances. But I think what we need to do is provide a reasonable, neutral framework that, with appropriate safeguards, that provides people with appropriate incentives to resolve these issues, you know, effectively in a given circumstance. But it needs to be adaptable to all those different circumstances.
Thanks.
I have one, though. I mean, the Australian proposal says that it's illegal to counsel somebody not to comply. So how do you, as somebody who receives one of these, challenge it?
So it's illegal to say...
It's illegal to counsel someone not to comply with these things in the Australian proposal. I mean, I just, if we're going to talk about, like, how does the process write itself, I'm concerned about things like that. Like, you know, I'm the person who gets called to ask to counsel people. Do I get to say, no, wait, let me figure out whether it's okay yet by asking a judge? Or do you have to comply and then I have to deal with I think that's a fundamental thing that you get to do in everywhere else in the law.
I'll just quickly answer that. So that wording is just around a general criminal offense liability procedure. So it's aid abet counsel the commission of an offence, and the offence is unauthorised disclosure. So it's not allowed to counsel someone to disclose information that would be a breach of the unauthorised disclosure clause. If you wanted to engage someone for legal consultation, you would be able to do that.
Please join me thanking the panel.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Danny Weitzner for providing audio of the event. If you haven't done so already, please give us a rating and review wherever you found us and share us with your friends and followers on Twitter and Facebook. The Lawfare podcast is edited by Jen Pacha Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.